Savannah is America's first planned city, and our home has seen many planners since General James Oglethorpe laid out his grid and turned his attention to other matters nearly 300 years ago. Some of those land use gurus have proven to be visionaries. Others, not so much. Savannah's current chief planner, Metropolitan Planning Commission Executive Director Melanie Wilson, embraces Oglethorpe's legacy and seeks balance in our fast-growing city and county. Melanie Wilson is our guest on the May 14th, 2021 edition of The Difference Makers, presented by the Savannah Economic Development Authority. From the digital team at SavannahNow.com, this is Difference Makers, a podcast featuring interviews with Savannah's community leaders about what they do, how they do it, and why. I'm Adam Van Brimmer, and joining me for this episode is Metropolitan Planning Commission Executive Director Melanie Wilson. She's been on the job just 3 years now, but has already seen plenty of change as the Savannah area grows and develops at a rapid pace. Wilson shares insights on development trends and what needs to be addressed to assure Savannah's quality of life continues long into the future in today's Difference Makers interview. Joined on today's Difference Makers by Melanie Wilson, who is the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Planning Commission for Savannah and Chatham County. And Melanie has been on the job for about 3 years, and I think it's been like drinking out of a fire hose as she gets used to an area, a county, a city that has grown at an incredibly rapid rate, even with what we've experienced over the last year. I think she'll tell you as we get into this that she and her staff have been as busy as ever. But let's go ahead and start where we usually do, and that's to get to know Melanie a little bit better. Of course, when she came on a couple of years ago, we had some stories and some other things in the paper that talked about that she came from Augusta and she had an extensive planning and land use background. But let's go a little bit farther back than that, Melanie, and talk about you grew up in Hickory, North Carolina. How'd your family end up in Hickory? What's the story there?
They were from Hickory and Newton in that whole area. So I spent my life there until it was time for me to go to college.
Right, right. What was it like growing up in a small town?
It's the county, I grew up in Newton, as they would say, Newton. And which is the county seat. It was different. You had a lot of manufacturing jobs. My class was the first integrated class to go through from the, kindergarten to high school. Mm-hmm. We're the first ones that had to pass a competency test to graduate. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of factory jobs and things of that nature. And with manufacturing, that provided a good living for a lot of the folks that lived in the community. They had choice if they didn't want to go to college. That was okay, but they definitely made sure that everybody could read and write, and everybody passed the competency test. It was kind of interesting. It's still a factory community. They were hit pretty hard during the
pandemic.
The change in policy. Well, they were hit hard when we basically ended up in a situation where. We did a lot of outsourcing with manufacturing and things of that nature.
Right.
So
right. It
drove unemployment rates up really high, and you ended up with folks that were used to making a really great salary, kind of getting their salaries cut in half because there just wasn't the type of work that they were used to. But interesting city still, or smaller city. It's still quite beautiful. It's right at the foothills, so you can see the mountains. And, we're an hour from Charlotte, so...
Was it mostly textiles and furniture or
textiles and furniture? You had Bassett, Carolina Mill. So, flour, we had Murdoch Berger, which was a German company that made magazines. So you had a little bit of everything, but a lot of Broadhill, a lot of furniture, a whole lot of furniture there.
Your parents, your family involved in that or what?
Yes.
What were they doing?
Yeah. They were heavily involved in the furniture, in the furniture business. That's for sure.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm a child of a manufacturing family as well. And I know that's an interesting way to live because shift work and they work hard and they come home. They get to be home involved with the kids and baseball and sports at evenings and art and recitals. And
I was lucky that my grandmother lived close by. So she always did dinner and things of that nature. And I will say that it was having the experience and the exposure to a factory life that made me realize I needed to go to college. I worked one night on a third shift job and I said, I can't do that.
I worked the summer at an auto plant and that was enough to convince me.
Yeah. And then I worked at a place that made gloves for electricians. So it was really hot and, you know, they dipped them and that was a mini shift from 5 to 9. And I did that for a while. And I had these wonderful little ladies that I called them the Beehive ladies, because they basically said, Melanie, we want you to study and get your work done and just help us close the boxes. So I am forever grateful to them because they were very supportive of, you know, my goal. I knew that I did not want to be working in a factory if I could help it. So I tell anybody, if you've got a child, send them south to work in a factory. They will know that college or getting some type of trade is really important.
That's exactly right. So what were you into? Were you into sports? You into music as a kid? Did you bicycle band. Around the neighborhood?
Band. I tell band. People band saved my life. Okay. Yeah, I played trumpet and baritone trumpet. So that was really great. And, you know, was in some science clubs and things of that nature.
Right. With the band, did you stick with it? How long did you?
I did. I started band in the 7th grade and I you know, kept it up. I played trumpet and baritone trumpet. So that was
marching band, jazz band,
jazz band. We had a regular a band that basically played classical or, you know, orchestra. So kind of did it all. But we were busy consistently the whole time. Our band was actually quite good. We made a trail race bus commercial when I was there. Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty interesting. You know, got to travel a lot and competed a lot, won a lot of awards. So our band was quite good.
Do you still pull the horn out and play a few notes?
My mother sold it in a yard sale.
Oh no.
Okay. You know, it's manufacturing, you know, she was like, you're not playing that thing.
No, I'm getting it out of here. Taking up space.
It's taking up space. So she sold it.
Were there some lessons involved with band that you applied? I mean, obviously, you got to be very coordination, collaboration, anything that really applied throughout your life?
Yeah, I think that I say band saved my life, but I think that band also taught me a lot of lessons with regards to working together as a team instinctively and working to try to help each other out. You know, you learn about hitting those lines and, you know, you have to be precise with regards to even the height of your march, stepping in place. And it taught me how to do multiple things at one time. I learned how to pivot because you have to be able to play, count to your mark when you're marching, and kind of just be aware of your environment. So I think most of my bandmates actually everybody went to college and are doing great things, from, you know, doctors to, you know, a couple of writers. And, you know, I've got one person that was a puppeteer, pretty famous, who's won a couple Emmys.
Nice.
So you just, you know, it just teaches you to, you know, respect others. You know, there it wasn't anything about color. So that was really kind of nice. You know, we were all a big team and you could letter. So everybody was proud to wear their jackets because people came to the games to see us play, just as much as they did to see the football team play or the basketball team play.
Right. So you ended up going to school at Chapel Hill and
yes, Carolina.
Political science and economics, you told me, yes. But you always seemed to think city planning was where you were going to go. What?
Well, actually, I was going to go to law school. Okay. I didn't know anything about planning, which is really kind of strange considering that Carolina at the time had the number one planning program in the country. It's something that I think a lot of kids don't grow up talking about, especially when you grow up in a town that's very heavily laden in textiles. Mm-hmm. But a friend of mine said, hey, I'm taking this class. You might be interested in it. It had policy as well as the law, because you have to know land use law. Mm, gotcha. So I took an intro class and I just fell in love with it. I said, this is what I want to do. I saw how powerful it could be if it's done correctly. I saw how the damage that was done from bad planning, even in Atlanta, where the highway basically divided a community. And that, you know, if you, it created a lot of segregated barriers. You know, people talk about somebody living over the railroad tracks.
Right.
You know, I lived on the other side of the railroad track, so I understood that. You know, you walk from point A to point B, and it wasn't just the people of color, it was lower wealth folks that lived there as well. Somebody had to make those decisions, and I said I wanted to be in the room and try to be a voice that at least voiced an opinion from a different perspective that some people don't always have. That mean I'm always right, and I don't profess to be that, but I think that when you've got lots of ideas, you end up with a better product.
Right. So once you embraced that and you went home for a holiday or something like that, or ended up in Charlotte, once you start to recognize that and embrace that, does it kind of change how you view everywhere you go? Do you
yes.
start to analyze?
It does. It does. I mean, I think that you once you embrace looking at some of the things, you start really kind of when you're growing up, I think that people always say, well, why is this here or how did that happen? I think that a lot of people don't know what planners do. When you think about, you know, you go shopping and you've got landscaping in a parking lot, people don't realize that some planner basically said, hey, it really is important to have some trees to help provide shade because that's good for the environment and good for people that are parking in those areas. Or, you know, just basic things that people take for granted, somebody has worked with somebody, whether it's a community and or a developer, to come up with something that creates a good transition or a good impact on the community in which they're going into. So yeah, it makes you question a lot of stuff. And it makes you also realize that sometimes advocacy for some things could have really horrible consequences. And that happened in a Charlotte area where someone was quite proud of themselves for stopping a road. But what it did was it kind of created this situation where they ended up having to put a toll road in because they just couldn't get people centered around the area fast enough without it bottlenecking.
Right, right. I don't want to necessarily take us down a tangent, but that's one thing that I always notice when I look at zoning board agendas and I see variance requests. And you know, I'll know somebody that has something and they'll talk about it and I'll be like, yeah, but you're thinking about how you're going to use it. But what they do changes it forever.
Forever.
And
that's correct.
Creates a lot of things for other things. What happens when you go to sell it, or what happens when people don't, I guess it's what's right in front of you and what affects you directly is what people think about. And in you guys' position, you've got to think more holistically.
And we have to think more globally. I think that, you know, I have been a big proponent of asking folks to stop coming in with the pretty pictures unless they're going to have it as a part of the record, because, you know, it might not be what they're showing. And people kind of get that design and that idea in their heads. And when it doesn't happen as somebody is showing it, then they're really ticked off. Right. And I stress to our board as well as to staff to remember that just because someone says they want to use it for, you know, this particular use, that the table permitted uses allows for a whole bunch of stuff, and it could be any of those uses. So you That's have right. to look at all of the uses when making a land use decision.
Yeah. Well, you finished up your education, you launched a career that's taken you a lot of places between then and now. Can you kind of walk us through your journey, your professional journey?
Yeah, I actually worked over in London with Dr. Tom Blair at the Polytechnic of Central London doing kind of housing as far as coming up with a concept for housing that could be used in areas that were hit with massive mudslides. It was like Madras, India, and some other places that really had problems. And we worked on good design, and we also worked on coming up with a community financing tool that would allow them to be able to pay for it. So, you know, the design had to have the ability to support infrastructure. So it basically ended up being kind of like a 500 square foot cube that you could add onto as they made more money.
Okay.
And then we worked with some other folks to set up a community banking system in, you know, That was really interesting. They could paint them bright colors and do whatever they would like to do with those buildings. But it really made for it a really interesting experience. But on stateside, I worked in Winston-Salem City County Planning Commission. And of course, anybody that's been there knows that we have an incredible historic preservation district, but probably one of the oldest consolidated planning groups in probably in the country. I think we've always been consolidated as a city county planning commission. The other services weren't, but planning was. And that was a great experience because I had to know five zoning ordinances. And we finally worked together to come up with unified development ordinance. And, you know, from there I was in Reidsville as the director of planning and then went to Garner. Each city, each community different, you know. Mm-hmm. Garner, with the whole town was a water supply watershed. So I spent a lot of time doing environmental and being really strategic about how that water was used. Mm-hmm. And worked at a housing authority being the director of development. So that was real fascinating because we were able to push for mixed use housing. And I kind of was one of the first to put one of the properties on the market at the Wall Street Journal to advertise it for sale so that mm-hmm. we could have, you know, start creating a partnership. So those areas now are fantastic. If you went to go see it, you wouldn't even know that it existed the way that it did when I was there. But we were one of the first to have central air conditioning. I kind of okay. proved that crime would go down if people weren't hanging out on the streets. Mm-hmm. And that occurred by having central air conditioning. So did that and then worked for ICF. So that was my private sector. So I've done public and private. And then ICF did Baltimore. So it just was this trajectory of small town, a little bit bigger town to housing authority, being the director of development and planning to private sector to the city of Baltimore being the deputy planning director to the National Capital Planning Commission.
Yeah, so, let's talk about that. I mean, that sounds like fun.
Actually, it was probably one of the jobs I hated the most.
There's a lot of red tape with the mall and all the.
It was a lot. I mean, it was a great job from the impact. I mean, we were responsible for, as a director for the office, you were responsible for planning for the mall as well as the capital budget. So that's any renovations to, you know, the Pentagon. We did that, the White House, all of it. We basically had to deal with those reviews. We had to update like the missions plan. So, you know, all the missions, I don't know if people realize they've got there's a plan for it, as well as the way that DC is set up. We had to initiate the update of their comprehensive plan, which is a little unusual for a federal agency to have that responsibility, but we were responsible for that. And it was the first year that GIPRA came into being. So it was really interesting going through that process with Congress and the Senate. So a lot of red tape, as I said, a job I went crazy about, but I was excited about doing some interesting stuff, but we're running out of space at the mall. So we pitched having monuments at the transit facilities, and they do now, so right. which is kind of cool. But we pitched that back then. I think the probably most interesting project that I worked on for the mall was the World War II museum and having the big debate with them about the sizing and massing of it. And making sure that we didn't do something and they didn't do something that would disrupt their view of the mall.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal. It was back and forth a lot.
Yeah.
Back and forth.
Yeah. Anytime you're dealing with something of that much of a spotlight on it, I'm sure that that's definitely the case.
Yeah. Anything on the mall had to come through our agency. So that was interesting. That's for sure.
Right. Right. I know you spent some time back in the research triangle with Wake County, right?
That's right. After that, I actually ended up working for Governor Glenn Denning's Office of Smart Growth. That was when it kind of took off and was a director of policy and programs. And then 9/11 hit. And my family said, can't you find a job in North Carolina? or you don't have to travel and roam so much. So I ended up applying and was hired to be the director of planning for Wake County, which is the capital county in the Research Triangle, and was there for, goodness, 7.5 years. And that was an interesting job in that, you know, not only do you work with all of the jurisdictions, elected officials, as well as their city managers, and, you know, had monthly meetings with the planning directors to talk about strategy with regards to having transition areas. Wake County was huge. It's over 847 square miles. We had a large environmental areas, water supply, watershed. We had the Sharon Harris nuclear facility. So it was looking at guiding development so that you didn't have too much intensity in some of those areas where people couldn't get out if there was an event. It was the first time that I had to think about people having to get iodine, you know, those iodine pills in case they got exposed to radiation.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. What brought you to Georgia?
My husband retired from Duke. Mm-hmm. He's a doctor. And this ended up being an adventure. I was, you know, after Wake County, I ended up partnering with a firm of folks that actually had gone to UVA with and did a lot of work when Aura was out. So I built several transit facilities throughout the state of North Carolina. People don't realize that back then you could not spend county funds on roads. So I got really interested when I knew I couldn't. I mean, I could do a plan, and I did a collector street plan and some other stuff, but I could not deal with any of the implementation. So that was one of the things that I wanted to do, was to kind of do some transportation, deal with some transit. So I did a lot of intergovernmental coordination with all the jurisdictions to look at, you know, BRT systems and other transit and transportation networks in the triangle. That was one of the big things that, you know, was needed. And again, did everything from, we finished up Apple Cart to building several transit facilities, Jackson County, you know, down to the coast in the Newburgh area. And that was a lot of fun. Did a lot of work with the airports with their statewide plans, and then worked a lot with others with regards to procurement, making sure that everybody was following the process on the DOT side. So that was a lot of fun. And I did that for until I came to Augusta, actually. And I ended up, just by happenstance, somebody heard me speak and they asked me if I would consider applying to be the director of planning and development there. So I did. And I did, if you know anything about North Carolina, they have an ABC commission. So I always wanted to learn about alcohol. And in Augusta, I was over all of the alcohol and business licensing, as well as all, you know, all construction, planning, development, and the MPO, which was a bi-state MPO. So that was interesting, and, you know, got a lot of kind of interesting stuff done, and had fun working in Augusta. I didn't like code enforcement, which I had there. I also had code enforcement with one of my earlier jobs, and it's never fun, you know, to have to see people living in really horrible conditions that you really don't have any control over. And you can't do anything, you know, you can do nominal things for. So I did that, and then, you know, so who wouldn't want to come to Savannah if nothing else to work MPC as a planner? It's the oldest planned city in the country. So that's kind of my trajectory of career and kind of how I ended up here.
We interrupt this Difference Makers interview with Melanie Wilson to tell you about the Difference Makers presenting sponsor and a real difference maker in our community, the Savannah Economic Development Authority. You may have seen recently where a highly respected trade journal named the Savannah area the number one locale for economic development in the country among like-sized markets. That standing is a credit to the folks at CETA, who have and are pushing to make Savannah a great place to work and live. CETA is committed to creating, growing, and attracting jobs and investment to the Savannah region. Learn more about the Savannah Economic Development Authority and what they do in the Savannah community by visiting CETA.org. Now back to the discussion with Melanie Wilson.
When they recorded you. I mean, you mentioned the oldest planned city, but at the same time, a lot of the things we were talking about earlier are problems here, whether it's, you know, interstates that have segregated parts of the community. And, once you get beyond the historic district, it's not the best planned place. Did those challenges and everything else, did that kind of excite you, get you excited to come and tackle that?
Well, it did. I mean, I like a challenge. I think that, you know, you kind of laugh sometimes because you don't realize it's as big of a challenge.
Right.
But I'm all about trying to get everybody to work together. So we've been able to, for example, we're working with Pooler and Garden City on their comprehensive plan. We're doing that update for them. We deal with natural resources with Bloomingdale. I kind of go and talk to everybody to see what we can do to try to help them and partner with them so that we can have a little bit more cohesiveness. Because just like stormwater and roads, nothing stops at a line. So if you've got some common themes, it makes everybody's life easier as development starts to happen.
Right.
So it's an ongoing task, but we're still working on it.
You mentioned comprehensive plan, and I know that's something that for Savannah and Chatham is something you've been working on. Can you kind of give us the broad strokes of that, and what does the public need to know, or what does the public need to do to get involved here as the process continues?
Well, we have to, you know, every 5 years we have to update the comprehensive plan, and that is what is needed in order to continue to get funds for CDBG and other state funding. So it kind of covers usually a general broad sweep of housing and natural resources and quality of life and things of that nature. This time they added technology, so we're looking at areas with regards to broadband. We are adding another area where we're talking about doing kind of neighborhood profiles so that we can at least have a little bit more of an overview. I found it was really interesting and kind of tough actually to find a lot of data on some of these neighborhoods. You know, you hear about Savannah, but you only hear about, components of it. You don't hear about all of it. So we're taking the opportunity to do a little bit more detail, look at kind of where development should occur based on infrastructure and capital programs. But it's the document that we have to have approved, and our goal is to try to go to the board starting in July to start the approval process, because we have to have it submitted to the state by October. Mm-hmm. So we'll start that. We'll go back around to them in July and August and hopefully start getting the approvals, because we have to get approvals from the four cities that we're working with. So that we've got a finalized document then. So it's important. We've had a number of surveys, and we're working now on putting together the draft. So if you go to our website, either www.thempc.org, you'll see a box that says Plan 2040. We also have a separate 2040.org website as well, but it's probably easier just to launch it from our website. Mm-hmm. And it gives you additional information about the plan, and we'll start having the drafts up there. So if there's feedback and comments that people want to share with us, then we're definitely glad that people are interested and will welcome feedback and comment.
Right. And you've been collecting information for a while now through some virtual means and some other means?
We have. We've been collecting information for this project since January. We've had ads on television, and we've done a number of surveys. We've had neighborhood meetings. One of the good things about technology is that it allows you to reach a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And we've done that, and we've gone to other centers where you had older residents that might not have had the technology to do presentations and talk to them about what some of their needs are. So we're still, it's a living document, but we're still working on it. But we're also starting to do some rough draft writing now.
Right.
In order to stick with our schedule.
Gotcha. a lot of that work then applies down the road to zoning ordinances and which in tweaks and updates and that kind of thing. And I know that most people are aware that NUZO for the city of Savannah has passed or has been implemented for a while now. The county did not end up adopting a new zoning ordinance, but they have some updates that are coming, right? What are some of the things that you guys are tackling?
We're working with them to look at some of the updates that kind of are needed to keep up with some of the current development trends. We're looking at everything from updating their definitions, for example, for accessory uses, accessory buildings, coming up with some additional performance standards for a few of the districts that they've got, and maybe introduce another district or two for them to have in their toolkit to use. So we've started kind of looking at areas that need to be updated and have started doing some, you know, discussions with the administrative folks over at the county. And we will continue to do that. And of course, the ordinance, as we look at a few of the pockets of the land use plan that need to be tweaked, will help guide what some of the additional proposals for change might be in the future.
Right, right. Another big part of what the MPC handles is historic preservation because of the landmark district and the other things we have in town. And this May, of course, is Historic Preservation Month. As you look at historic preservation and downtown and even outside of downtown, what are some of the trends that are jumping out at you? I know you're pretty busy dealing with that stuff, right?
Yes, this is Historic Preservation Month, and my staff, Leah Mahalik and her team, you know, have come up with some really cool stuff. We've got an Instagram page, and we're doing additional just videos to talk about historic preservation and a few other things that would be helpful to people that live in the district. We've got a new board. One of the things that happened with NUZO was that it created a historic preservation commission, as well as kind of several of the districts that go with that. So we've got probably we've just been really, really busy with the amount of proposals or development that has come into the district. I think that one of the challenges, though, that we have with having the historic districts that we've got is that a lot of people, when they buy, they might not know that they're in a district. It could be an area that they think is really neat, but just outside of the landmark district or outside of a, you know, a streetcar district, but they're in a district, and them having an understanding about how districts are created. We don't just pull them out of our, you know, thin air. Usually the neighborhood kind of starts the initiation of trying to create a district. And if it's appropriate, then it moves forward. But they generally spend a lot of time themselves doing a lot of the legwork. I found that some of the folks that want districts really are probably looking to have area plans because they want to try to control what happens in their neighborhoods or in the community. And a district that necessarily do that.
Right. Right. It can complicate.
It can make it complicated in a sense. You know, the goal of the district isn't to hammer or hit anybody over the head with regulations, but there are some things that are part of a district that have to be met based on the conditions and the criteria that everybody has agreed on, from the neighborhood that wanted that particular district, whether it is roofing and roofing materials or, you know, everything down to, you know, additions, whether the favorite, as you know, hardy board, whether it can be used or not, and things of that nature. Because some of the newer districts that, you know, have come on, you know, the question we keep getting asked is, can we use hardy board? Can we use hardy plank? So a lot of challenges. And this time around, we're spending a little bit more time with some of the people in the district to look at what the costs are you know, if you were not in a district, it would cost you this amount. If you're in the district, this is what the cost is, just so that people can plan for it. And I just want to remind people that we're available if people are in a district and they're thinking about doing any updates or renovations, to just call us. We'll be glad to talk to you and help you where we can.
Speaking of historic districts, let's talk a little bit about downtown. Certainly the last 20 years have been an immense amount of change downtown. We still got some big things to come. I think most people think downtown, they think, oh, well, we've seen Plant Riverside, we've seen stuff at the other end of the street. But now we've got some decisions ahead of us in terms of the Civic Center site. And, of course, they're building a courthouse annex. They're building something on the lot there on Oglethorpe Avenue. As you look at kind of how things are evolving downtown from a planner standpoint, from a land use standpoint, I also kind of neglected to talk about kind of the hotel map and kind of what's allowed to be built where. As you look at the evolution the last couple of years, is it are you pleased with what you're seeing? Are you a little concerned with what you're seeing? What, from a land use standpoint, do we need to know?
I think that's kind of a tough question. I think my biggest
question.
It's a loaded question. I think my biggest concern is I don't want Savannah to lose its soul. Right. People come to Savannah because it's special. You've got really good architecture. You've got massing that's appropriate in scale to what's existing. You don't have what I call gentrified architecture, which are just boxes all over the place. You've got stuff that, you know, is interesting. And we've seen some good stuff that people have done, and I've seen some things that are kind of questionable. But I just hope that as we look forward as a community, that people remember that, you know, the historic district is the moneymaker. I mean, people from a tourist standpoint, they come to see Savannah, and they come to see the beautiful buildings and architecture in Savannah. And I think that people like experiencing the people of Savannah. I'm concerned, honestly, about some of the dark blocks that you have, because and that's why I talk about it not losing its soul. You know, when you have people around and you have them consistently around, it's a very different experience versus having a row of buildings that might be used for Airbnbs and they're just dark half the time. That is very different than having the life of, you know, continuous movement and people on the streets. So that's kind of what I see, and just some quick thoughts about that.
Yeah. I get a little nervous when I see stuff like the old Chatham Academy, where the Board of Education is, and it, you know, they put it up for sale, and you're like, oh, what's going to happen there? And then you look at the Civic Center, and you think about all these great things that could happen on the Civic Center site, but you're really not sure which way it's going to go. And then you go down toward the river and you see what's happening. I guess it might even be outside the historic landmark district there at Farm Street and Indian Street, and just to the west of where Plant Riverside is. And you're just, it's just like, this is all great, but we like you said, we got to kind of keep our eye on what made downtown special.
Yeah. When you start losing that, as I said, just make sure that we don't lose our soul. When you start losing that, you can't get it back.
It's hard to get back.
Right. It's very difficult to get back. So that's why I'm, you know, we've got, I think, citizens that are concerned, but I think there's balance even with that. But I do think that it's important to just have good architecture, good design, and have that be in scale with what's existing. Just looking at all of it comprehensively. So, because you're right, even looking at the area on River Street from the water, it becomes a different experience as you start from one end where you've got Eastern Worth going down toward the ports. Changed dramatically, even in the past 5 years.
Yeah,
with what you experience.
Yeah, in another 5 years, they're not going to recognize it. Another 5 years.
That's probably right.
That's the interesting thing about down there.
Again, you are listening to a conversation with Metropolitan Planning Commission Executive Director Melanie Wilson. While she takes a short break, I have a call to action for you. Subscribe to SavannahNow.com. Our website is the best place to keep up with community news, sports, and yes, opinion makers. And right now, you can get 6 months access for $6. I'm not a mathematician, but that works out to $1 a month. I didn't even have to use my smartphone calculator for that one. It's a pretty good deal. Go to SavannahNow.com or download our app and see our product for yourself. Then hit the subscribe button to get full access. Now, back to the Difference Makers interview.
Let's spend the balance of our discussion talking a little bit about infrastructure, talking about what's going on in some of the growth and development areas in town. And I know that that is something that when you talk about a comprehensive plan, when you talk about a vision for 2040, you're trying to project ahead and make sure that your road networks, your transportation, your planning, your land use, your master plans for your subdivisions, that everything is planned in such a way that it is all linked together and cohesive and works together at the end. What are some of those things that you see and you're encouraged by? You say, yeah, we're going at that the right way. We're getting ahead or at least keeping up with where we need to be to tackle traffic in this area or infrastructure in this area or stormwater in this area. Are there a couple of things that jump out at you?
I think that the fact that people are having a discussion about stormwater management is really important, and we're having conversations, which is something that's important to me, regarding sea level rise and resiliency. Mm-hmm. I was kind of surprised that we didn't have kind of a more robust plans, because we are a coastal city, to deal with resiliency and sustainability. It's nice from the NPO standpoint, because I'm the executive director of that as well, that we are starting to look at not only that, but looking at the impact of sea level rise on road networks and looking at it kind of more regionally versus just Savannah itself, because it's all interrelated, as well as stormwater. Water does not stop at a line or a county boundary. And we need to have, I think, more discussion about that as development occurs. One of the things that I also that concerns me, and I talk about some, is the amount of lot coverage for impervious surface and the fact that it's important to have some green area for just water to go. A lot of that has gone away, and that's not initially a good thing.
Right.
When you don't have appropriate green space for that.
When you look to the west side of the county in particular, your road networks, of course, Jimmy DeLoach is about to connect, which I think will take a lot of the port traffic pressure off. But then you've also got the city of Savannah, of course, doing all that work out in the New Hampstead area that's going to start to come online, some of the stuff off Little Neck Road. What are you seeing out that direction? What do we need to keep in mind?
Just a lot of development activity kind of proposed for that area out there. And the road network right now is not necessarily keeping up with that. So that's going to be one of the challenges with regards to proposed development, is making sure that the road network and the other infrastructure is appropriate. And I know that the city and the county are both working on that. But that's crucial as the city continues to grow and the county continues to grow with development. I've seen more in a kind of development even occur in the county in some areas where you probably wouldn't have thought that it would occur. For the areas, New Hampstead, you know, you've got a lot of big new projects that are coming or that will be coming online. And that's going to be quite interesting to see what those potential challenges will be with having that, but it's something that can be addressed as you go through plan review as far as some of the improvements that are needed. Jimmy, the Duran project is moving ahead, and that's kind
project
of
project Duran. Right.
Project Duran is exciting. I think that that's going to help a lot too with regards to keeping traffic moving. So a lot of road projects that are taking place. You know, the airport continues to do really neat stuff, and I think sometimes people forget about them, but they are part of the network as well as the ports. They're doing a lot with regards to expansion and things of that nature that will continue to bring people here and cause the need for not only more housing, but, you know, warehousing. That's why that super site that was just done will be interesting to see how it develops out based on projected needs for the ports.
Right, right. You mentioned housing, and of course, right now we are housing supply hasn't necessarily kept up with demand, and you're starting to see a lot of master plans for subdivisions come through the MPC. Are you seeing good stuff? Or are you encouraging? Is you and your staff encouraging some things?
One of the things that I would like to see, and I've encouraged people to do, is start looking more holistically at having a good design for layout, a true village concept where you've got your commercial on the inside and you've got good movement and synergy. When you've got these large subdivisions, they end up being little mini towns. So people need to be able to, you know, experience them that way without feeling like they've got to get in a car to go every single place. You know, so I would say that it's one of the things that we have encouraged the engineers and architects to consider when they are putting these master planning documents together, that and connectivity to adjacent properties. And that's with road networks. I mean, I've seen a lot of projects that have come been approved, I guess, in the past where you had one way in and one way out and you got an awful lot of houses there. And you always are concerned about, is there going to be a bottleneck if there's an accident? How do people get out at that entry point? So that's the other thing that I've been encouraging people to do is to make sure that that there is a connection to the adjacent property, especially if it's a large track, so that people have multiple ways to come in and out of particular subdivisions. So
and the other
yeah.
piece of that is transit. Right. As he starts.
Well, the other piece of it, it definitely is transit. I think that, you know, as you are expanding out into these areas, and I've talked with the transit, the folks over at CAT about, you know, kind of looking at where they're projecting new routes to go, and they might need to tweak them based on what I'm seeing for land development patterns and growth. So we will continue to work with them to look at their routes and things of that nature. But you've got that. You've got the issue, of course, with housing affordability, which is huge. And the need to make sure that you've got a mix of housing type that's also in the center area. You know, not everybody can live or should be pushed, you know, to the south or to the west or whatever. You have better opportunities to get people to kind of work if people don't have, you know, hour and a half commute to be able to come work, especially when you're in a tourist industry type job.
You have to be self. And that's a big challenge ahead for the city, right, is finding out how to do some things to make workforce housing, affordable housing, a greater problem.
I think that it's a challenge for everybody. I don't see it as just a city problem or challenge. I think it's kind of a regional challenge. You rents are really high, and a starter home is very expensive. I haven't seen anybody building $150,000 houses at all. Everything has a two in front of it with some additional numbers, and I think sometimes people don't think about the fact that, you know, if you've got a couple of kids, it's really hard for them to get their down payment and to have some other things to happen to even get into a house. But I think the other challenge is that, you know, you want to make sure that if somebody does have that opportunity, that they've got enough land to be able to do something with. You know, if they've got a lot that's super, super small, then they can't entertain or do anything. So they're just in a house. Yeah. So there's a balance that I think everybody's kind of looking for and will continue to look for with regards to trying to provide housing. And I think that we need to be innovative with the materials that we use for housing as well in order to get some of the costs down.
Right. Yeah. So especially right now. Lumber is very expensive. Right.
Lumber's expensive. Everything's expensive. But, you know, they're just different. They're different things that can be done. I mean, one of the things that I found was really fascinating was that there was a 3D house that was put up in New York. Mm-hmm. And it was built very quickly, no waste, and was put together fast. And it's 1,500 square foot 3D house. It was really neat, and it was done with concrete by the time it was finished. So
No hardy plank.
Hardy plank's okay in some of the outlying areas. That's something that could work in the county, but in some of the outer parts of the city, but not in the downtown area, not in the historic districts. No hardy plank. That's for sure.
Well, I think I can say, as somebody lives in this county, that I'm glad that you and your team down there are helping lead some of these conversations. And I really appreciate you taking the time and filling us in and educating us on all of this. And we'll look forward to big things to come.
Well, thank you for allowing me to come on today, or asking me to come on today. I really appreciate it. And I know Leah has been on here, so I'm going to let her have a shameless plug for Historic Preservation Month. About the activities, if you don't mind, that are taking place, so that people know specifically what we've got going. So are you there, Leah?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yep. Hi. So this is Leah Mahalik. We have a few things going on Preservation Month. Every day, beginning on May 1st, going through the end of the month, we're posting every day on our Instagram account, which is at MPC Historic Preservation, different topics every day of the week. And then on May 14th, we'll be doing a live presentation and Q&A regarding the Historic Site and Monument Commission, which I think is something that folks in town are much less familiar with than the Historic District Board of Review, say, for example, and what they do and what their purpose is. So we want to get that out there. Mm-hmm. And then on May 28th is a presentation regarding the local historic districts and the zoning ordinances that are associated with that. And most importantly, the review process and what that exactly means. We're trying to create a lot more awareness of people that don't know they're in a historic district and what that means. So those are our three events this month.
Great. Well, we'll definitely make sure those get some attention, and I appreciate you hanging in here, Leah. I know it's been a long conversation. And you too, Melanie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of Difference Makers. Thanks to Metropolitan Planning Commission Executive Director Melanie Wilson for being our guest. Learn more about what she and her organization do by visiting thempc.org. That's thempc.org. Thanks also to our presenting sponsor, the Savannah Economic Development Authority. Tap into the Difference Makers archives anytime on your favorite podcast app to hear more interviews with some of Savannah's community leaders, such as Quessy DeGraft Hansen, the force behind Savannah's annual Weeping Time Remembrance, the Ossabaw Island Foundation's Elizabeth DuBose, and Georgia Southern Athletic Director Jared Benko. Difference Makers is a production of the Savannah Morning News and SavannahNow.com. On behalf of myself and producer Zach Dennis, thank you for listening.